My name is Alex Tabarrok. I am the Vice President and Director of Research at the Independent Institute. I know that many of you have been here before. For those of you who have not, the Independent Institute is a nonpartisan public policy research organization. In conjunction with scholars across North America and Europe, we produce many books, a journal, a quarterly journal, the Independent Review, this one, and policy forums such as the one we're here at tonight. The Institute's publications and policy forums cover a wide variety of issues. Some of our recent books, for example, examine the American healthcare system, monetary policy and theory, the economics of high-tech industry, and other topics. I do want to draw your attention tonight, however, to a couple of publications of specific interest to tonight's forum. The first is our book, That Every Man Be Armed, by noted constitutional lawyer Stephen Halbrook. That Every Man Be Armed analyzes the constitutional history of the Second Amendment from its common law origins in England through to the founding period and on through to modern developments. I think it's fair to say that Halbrook and That Every Man Be Armed in particular have been influential in the debate over the Second Amendment. In fact, in helping to put the Second Amendment back on solid legal ground, so that today it is widely recognized among constitutional scholars that the Second Amendment does protect an individual right, a finding which was controversial, even scoffed at, when the first edition of That Every Man Be Armed first came out. I'd also like to point to our monograph, Fire and Smoke, which is by George Mason University law professor Michael Krauss. This monograph offers what is frankly a devastating legal analysis of the government recoupment suits, so-called recoupment suits, for tobacco and against tobacco and gun manufacturers. Anyone concerned with democracy and with the rule of law will be interested in Fire and Smoke. Tonight's forum, however, is not about the constitutional right to keep and bear arms. It is about the effect of guns and gun control on our society. What is the relationship between guns and crime? What is the relationship between gun control and crime? Does gun control work? What sort of gun control? Is gun crime increasing? What about accidents? What about children and guns? What does the international evidence tell us? I'm very pleased today to be introducing two of the most highly regarded and prominent researchers on firearms to help us answer these questions and other questions. Gary Kleck is professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Florida State University. He is the author of dozens of scholarly papers in the fields of criminology and several books, including Point Blank, Guns and Violence in America. The American Society of Criminology called Point Blank the most outstanding contribution to criminology in the preceding 3 years, when it awarded that book a medal and award in 1993. Targeting Guns, this book, which is available tonight, is an update and extension of Gary's prize-winning Point Blank. David Coppell is the research director for the Independence Institute, okay, which is located in Colorado. Somehow, he also finds time, I'm not sure how, to be an associate policy analyst with the Cato Institute, director of the Center on the Digital Economy at the Heartland Institute, and also an adjunct professor of law at the New York University School of Law, not exactly near to Colorado. Before joining the Independence Institute, he was Assistant Attorney General for the state of Colorado. And he is the author of many scholarly articles and books, including The Samurai, the Mountain, and the Mountains, Samurai, the Mountie, and the Cowboy, which was named the 1992 Book of the Year by the American Society of Criminology. He is also the author of Guns, Who Should Have Them, which contains a really wonderful set of essays on all aspects of guns and gun control. We're indeed very lucky and pleased to have such superb scholars with us tonight. Let me begin by turning it over to Gary Kleck.
Thank you all. All right, the secret's out. I'm not Ted Nugent. Try to pass myself off as Ted Nugent, but I don't have the hair for it. I am a criminologist. I'm not a political figure, but I'm an academic in an incredibly politicized area, which means I can hardly be unaware of the political implications of what I say, but although it doesn't really sound like it's much of a distinction, I actually try to make an effort to start with evidence and move to conclusions rather than the other way around. But in fact, most people in this area, basically, they start with a set of conclusions, and then it's invariably easy to find some evidence that supports almost any knuckleheaded conclusion you want to arrive at. It's a reflection of the fact there's a lot of bad evidence out there. So my task is really separating the good evidence from the bad evidence, and I think it can be done on purely technical grounds. It's boring for people who are not methodologists. It's kind of boring even for people who are methodologists, but I think the best guide to knowing, for example, whether guns cause violence or more gun control would reduce violence is by making the soundest technical judgments about how good the research was that generated the evidence. And if you don't do that, basically what you'll find is, first of all, 90% of everything is crap. 90% of the research is crap, which means if all you're going to do, if you're not willing to make the technical judgments, I mean, everybody basically has to fall back on vote counting. You know, I mean, well, there's 9 studies that say yes and 1 that says no, and so, well, that's a consensus. There's a lot of people who say yes, and of course, my stance would be if the best available evidence is in that 1 study that says no, the answer is no. So I'd like to give you a brief overview of what I think we know about the subject of guns and violence and gun control, starting with the simplest of all insights, and this one leads to just about every other insight, which is that guns are instruments of power. They increase people's ability to do whatever they want. That, of course, means that people who want to murder people have an enhanced ability to do that. Guns enable people who are small and weak to kill people who are large and strong. They allow you to kill people at a distance. A gun may not be essential to killing, but at 1,000 yards, it's a heck of a help, is one of the common observations. But on the other hand, if you are the weaker, smaller party and you are being victimized, guns conversely have the exact opposite effect. They prevent violence because basically the aggressor wants somebody to be hurt, the victim obviously does not want to be hurt, and in fact usually doesn't even want to hurt the person who is aggressing against them. So for example, many issues in the debate over guns and violence, they're not so much a matter of are there certain effects of having guns, it's a matter of how much. It boils down to a quantitative issue. All but the most fanatical advocates of one position or another will concede that guns both help criminals do crime and help victims defend against it. It's just a matter of how often that happens. I'm probably most frequently cited for one little small part of the research I do, which is on defensive gun use. In fact, if most of you have heard my name, it's probably in connection with one single number. One little number. You know, they're going to put it on my tombstone when I'm dead. 2.5 million defensive gun uses per year. And you'd think that was the only research I ever did. That's actually one survey. It was a national survey, and it was really about the simplest piece of research you could imagine. It's just using standard sampling techniques to get a representative sample of Americans and then asking them, in the past year, have you used a gun for self-protection? And we'd ask a series of questions to find out exactly what it is they thought was a defensive gun use, and a lot of it wasn't, and you rule out that stuff. And just like Gallup projects how many people are going to vote for a particular political candidate based on their representative sample, we do the same thing. Admittedly, a lot harder to call that election than it was to call the number of defensive gun uses, but... I'm from Tallahassee, as a matter of fact, which is the center of the political universe right now. The long and the short of it is probably the highest estimate of the number of crimes committed in any one year with a gun is about 1 million versus about 2.5 million defensive gun uses, which means most of the time when somebody's using a gun in connection with a crime, it's a victim. But when a victim does it, of course, obviously the offender doesn't want the cops to know about it, but neither normally does the victim, because it's just going to get you in trouble. Nobody's going to give you a medal for using a gun in self-protection, even if what you did was legal, and it could get you arrested. Maybe eventually cleared, but it could get you arrested in the meanwhile. So it's sort of an invisible phenomenon, and basically the only way you could get at it is by doing anonymous confidential surveys where at least some of those people who had that experience were willing to tell you about it. But I routinely assume that in surveys, people hold back a lot of stuff that they consider to be risky to tell a stranger on the phone about. So I assume as a routine matter, of course, that in fact the actual numbers are larger. Those are like minimum baseline figures. When a criminal has a gun, on the other hand, its significance is not that it increases how many people will go out and commit crimes. Its main significance appears to be that it just makes the consequences more lethal, meaning for every 100 assaults that are committed with a gun, you have a larger fraction that will end in a death than if you had 100 people get in a fight without any weapons or with a knife and so on. That is the core of the case for gun control. And it's true as far as it goes. It's valid as far as it goes. The core surrounds homicide. If you're going to do any good with gun control, it's in reducing homicide, and it's basically you're going to accomplish it by lowering the fatality rate of assaults. There'll be the same number of people getting mad at one another and attacking one another, but a smaller fraction of the victims will die. And indeed, if that were the only use that's made of guns, then the issue would be solved. The issue would be resolved right there. We ought to restrict guns, and indeed, the more we could restrict them, the better. Especially if you don't place any value, as millions of Americans do, on target shooting or hunting and so forth. In fact, it would make sense to take everybody's guns away. If the only effect of guns was that it increased the number of people who die in homicides, then you'd want to take everybody's guns away on the off chance they might get stolen from a law-abiding person and then used in a crime, or passed on hand to hand until they finally end up in the hands of somebody who kills with it. But it's not the only thing that guns are used for. Even leaving aside recreational uses, And I think most gun control advocates would sort of dismiss that as trivial anyway. How can the pleasure of hunting compare with the loss of a human life? I think if you're going to make a strong case for gun control, you basically have to argue that those benefits of saving some lives by reducing the fatality rate of assaults exceed any cost that comes from taking guns away from victims who would have used them for self-protection. That's why there's just so much heat about this issue of how often and with what effect do people use guns for self-protection. Because it's sort of the trump card of the anti-control or pro-gun folks, just as raising the lethality of assaults is the trump card of the pro-control folks. As to when victims use guns, they have basically the opposite effects of when offenders use them, for the simple reason that victims have opposite goals. They want to avoid injury. And indeed, people who use guns for self-protection are less likely to be injured. They're also, in robberies, less likely to lose property. In burglaries, they're less likely to have the burglary committed against them. The surveys suggest that women rarely use guns in attempts to rape them. It's probably true that it is fairly unusual, simply because gun ownership is much lower among women than among men. Or it may be partly the usual unwillingness of women to talk about rape experiences in general, and also, you know, doubly unlikely to want to discuss the use of a deadly weapon that itself might be legally questionable. As to what the overall effect is, you got some good effects of victims using guns, and you've got some bad effects of criminals using guns. The net effect appears to be zero. It's a wash. That is, if you don't distinguish between good guy ownership and bad guy ownership, where there are more guns, it has zero net effect on the overall amount of homicide, suicide, robbery, aggravated assault, and so forth. Now, actually, in terms of public policy, what we really want to do is make a distinction between good guys and bad guys, because really the optimum, to the extent that you can accomplish it, is take guns away from as many bad guys as you can manage to do without significantly reducing those valuable defensive uses among non-criminals. And it's easy enough to say, well, that's, you know, how are you going to distinguish good guys from bad guys? But of course, the law has done it for centuries. There's really typically two groups of people in the world. There's those who have been convicted of a crime in the past and those who haven't. Does that perfectly divide the world into good guys and bad guys? No, because there's bad guys who escape justice and there's good guys who are falsely convicted. But it's a pretty workable distinction. The folks who do have a criminal conviction are way more likely to do an act of violence in the future than the folks who don't. And so it's a practical value in making that distinction. And so, of course, any licensing law or any background check law is based on making that distinction. You want to get a gun now, under the Brady law, you have to go into the gun store and be identified, and then they do a telephone records check, and they find out if you have a disqualifying characteristic, mainly a criminal conviction, and if you don't, you get the gun. If you do have that disqualifying attribute, you're denied. Nothing else happens to you, typically, although theoretically you could be arrested for the crime of attempting to purchase a gun when you're a convicted felon, but in fact nothing happens to you. And of course you're right to be skeptical about the value of a law that simply tells a criminal you can't get a gun from a gun store. If you didn't get it from the gun store, well, there's lots of other places to get guns. In fact, even for non-criminals, there's lots of other places. Any of us can look in classified ads and find them in most states anyway. We can ask a friend who already has a gun but is willing to sell one. We can do a number of things. And of course, criminals have yet another option, which is stealing. And stealing is a real hard nut to crack in controlling guns, starting with the fact that we've got a stock of on the order of 270 million guns in private hands. Roughly half of the households that you might randomly pick to burglarize have a gun in them. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be easy to get at it. Some people have them really secure, but if, on the other hand, you're in the kind of neighborhood where you are most likely to be burglarized, then for that very reason, you're not likely to have the gun so secure, because you want to have it available quickly for self-protection. So in precisely the places where gun theft is highest, that's where people in effect believe they can't afford to keep their guns secure against theft, because it also would imply keeping it inaccessible for defensive purposes. So as a result, you have probably at minimum 750,000 guns being stolen every year in the U.S. That's at minimum. That's almost certainly higher than that. That's one of those abstract numbers that doesn't mean anything, but to put it in perspective, that's almost certainly larger than the highest estimates of the number of gun crimes committed in recent years, which means you could literally seize every gun from every criminal in the entire country today, and a year's worth of theft would easily rearm them within a single year, just theft alone. And it's not necessarily that criminals always have to steal them themselves. They just buy them from somebody else they know who stole it, or they buy it from a guy who bought it from a guy who stole it. Probably most of the guns that end up in criminal hands were stolen somewhere along the line, and thereafter they just circulate among criminals. So does that mean any and all gun control is hopeless? No, it just places serious limits on what it can accomplish. There are undoubtedly some minimally motivated criminals who they're going to get in a fight somewhere along the line. They're going to commit an impulsive act of violence, and if they have a gun available, it's likelier they'll kill somebody, yet at the same time are not regularly stealing themselves, thus wouldn't come across a gun in a burglary, and don't know a lot of other criminals and thus don't have the same contacts to acquire guns. Are there a lot of such individuals? Probably not. But on the other hand, what pro-control folks always says, if it can just save one life, it's a mantra, you know, if it could just save one life, well, that is true as far as it goes. I mean, if the only effect of a particular regulation was it was going to save a life, who could vote against it? I mean, everybody would vote to save that life. But of course, really what you want to accomplish is save a life or two or hopefully, you know, at least a few dozen, while at the same time not costing lives by denying guns to people who would use them for self-protection to save their lives, which people undoubtedly do. Although, like all preventative measures, having a defensive gun on the premises, it's difficult to establish its value because, say I did use a gun in self-protection, say the guy who was menacing me looked like a terrible human being who really wanted to kill me. Say he even told me he was going to kill me. And then I use the gun to intimidate him and he runs off or I capture him for the police or whatever. I still don't know for sure I saved a life. Even if he promised he was going to kill me, I still don't know for sure. It's inherent in the nature of preventative measures of all sorts. You can never be absolutely certain that in this particular instance your preventative measure worked. But part of the evidence that there is that kind of preventive thing going on is the fact that if you take otherwise identical criminal incidents, and in some of them the victims used guns for self-protection, and in others they did not, they're less likely to be hurt in the ones they used guns for self-protection. It is not true that on net, using a gun for self-protection provokes the criminal into attacking the person. Maybe there are individuals that see the sight of a gun and they're provoked into violence against the person holding it, but, you know, it's a little more common that they're basically frightened, as any rational person would be. What does this imply for good gun control? Well, number one, you basically do want to make that distinction between the good guys and the bad guys. Which means you make distinctions like, did they pass a background check? And if so, well, they can have a gun. If not, they can't. In other words, I think the Brady Act was on the whole, if it doesn't go any further than it does, it's all right. You know, it's a modest step. But you'll often hear its supporters say it's a step in the right direction, which has an ominous sound to it because what it means is that's not really all they want. In fact, it's not necessarily even primarily what advocates want. Reporters will typically say you're paranoid if you think what Handgun Control Incorporated is really after is prohibition, and I don't think there's anything paranoid about that at all. I think that it's not like they have a secret plan on file at headquarters. Although on the internet somebody was circulating this fake memo on HCI letterhead. I don't know if you ever ran across that one, but you know it looks pretty plausible. I mean, you know, it could have been HCI, but it in fact wasn't because it'd be foolish for them to ever have any written document outlining long-term plans. And I think they could honestly say we don't have any long-term plans to push for prohibition because they don't have any long-term plans of any sort. I mean, it's basically, you know, catch-as-catch-can agenda of the moment, largely defined by the mass media. If the mass media publicizes a schoolyard shooting with an AK-47 imitation in Stockton, California, then suddenly there's an assault weapons push from HCI. You know, even though the folks at HCI never heard of an assault weapon or an AK-47, you know, the day before it happened, suddenly it's a part of their agenda, and then when the media lose interest, so does HCI. But having said that, I also think the logic of the gun controls movement's arguments imply you do have to go after all of the guns eventually. I think it's, even if it's not a matter of they have a detailed plan right now, it's something they would like to see happen. And if you could kind of inject the board of directors of HCI full of truth serum and get them on a polygraph and ask them, you know, do you support, would you vote, you know, if we're up to you, would you vote for banning all the guns? They'd say yes in a heartbeat. Now, I think the wrong implication to draw from that, which is basically the NRA's implication, is therefore we shouldn't do anything because doing anything could lead to going too far. You know, supporting any kind of even moderate gun control will lead to total prohibition. And I think if that logic were actually followed to its logical conclusion, we would never be able to do anything about anything. I mean, you know, why should we have punishments for murder? Because that might lead to having punishments for, you know, really trivial stuff, you know, sneezing out a turn, and, you know, who knows where that could lead to. If we have the death penalty for murder, pretty soon we'll have it for petty shoplifting, and then we'll have it for parking violations, and then we'll have it for speaking an angry word to your neighbor. And, of course, gun death penalty advocates never really follow that logic out, you know, to a conclusion that says we should not have the death penalty even for murder. You know, the sensible thing is, well, you do something as long as it'll do some good, and then when it ceases to do any good, stop. There's nothing inevitable about a slippery slope. It is what handgun control and the other major gun control organizations would like to achieve, but it's not what they necessarily will achieve. They can only achieve it to the extent that the citizenry allows them to achieve it. On the other hand, you've got the NRA's alternative to gun control, and it really just boils down to the general conservative strategy of controlling crime, which is more punishment. And really, it's even more specific than that. It's longer prison sentences. And longer prison sentences is as knuckleheaded in its conservative way as gun control, or at least the loonier versions of gun control, are there in their liberal way. The basic downside with the longer prison sentence alternative is, even if you're a believer in both the justice of severe punishment and its value for crime control, you really ought to think twice about advocating mandatory minimums, mandatory add-ons, or 10-20 life bills, and there's a thousand varieties of them all over the place, three strikes and you're out. They all have exactly the same thing in common. They tend to lengthen the average prison sentence served. Well, the problem with that is there is a trade-off between certainty and severity of punishment. If you have each prisoner serving a more severe, that is a longer prison sentence, it really means over any given length of time, given a fixed prison capacity, you can lock fewer different criminals up, meaning a smaller fraction of criminals get punished. What you've done is you've sacrificed certainty to get greater severity. And criminologists are agreed that if you have to pick one of the two, you'd rather have higher certainty of punishment. In other words, you'd rather have a higher percentage of crimes resulting in punishment than having a few people punished, but punished very severely. It's just deterrence works better when you maximize certainty rather than severity, and you cannot maximize both. And by the way, it doesn't matter if you double or triple the prison capacity. You're still faced with the exact same trade-off, only now you just have more prison spaces to play with. But it's still the same trade-off. You can't increase the average prison sentence length without reducing the number of criminals that over any given period of time you can punish. It's just like, how many hotel guests can you have if every guest decides they're going to stay for 10 years? You basically have whatever the capacity of the hotel is, and that's what you have for 10 years. It's also a kind of a dumb alternative to gun control, basically because crime is a young man's game. It's not sexist to say that. It's a young man's game. And the vast majority of crime is basically committed by people roughly between the ages of 13 and 25 or 29, if you want to push it. And if you really actually manage to convict and incarcerate a criminal much before the age of 18, I mean, it really has to be a hardcore juvenile offender to get sent to prison, or even to be recognized as somebody serious enough to lock up. Which basically means what you do is, by the time you find out he's somebody serious enough that you want to use a prison space to lock him up and gain what criminologists call an incapacitative effect, it just means he's physically incapable of doing a crime against the general public because he's locked up. By the time you find out he's somebody serious enough to put away like that, he's already 18, he's already at or past the peak of his crime-committing career, because it's a kid thing. He's on the downslide of his criminal career, so okay, you lock him up for 5 years, he's pretty close to it. He would have been pretty close to his peak, doing a lot of crime from the ages of 18 to 23. Lock him up for 10 years, Well, now you got him locked up from age 18 to age 28, and in those last 5 years, he wouldn't have been doing nearly as much crime had he been on the streets. And if you keep him in for 20 years until he's in his late 30s, he would have been doing hardly any crime at all. You're preventing practically no crime keeping him those last 10 years. And you might say, well, all right, preventing some crime is better than none. I mean, you know, and whatever crime you can prevent, great. But we are operating at 100% capacity in the prison system. So locking a guy up means there's somebody else you could have locked up that you can't now. And guess who that is? Who'd be likeliest that you'd want to lock up if you had that prison space? Some hot young stud who's doing a lot of crime because he's in those high crime ages. So you lock up the old farts, and you know basically what it means is there's no space for the folks who are really doing the crime, and that is the trade-off. Longer the prison sentence, the more you keep people in prison until they're into the old fart range rather than the hot young stud range. And that's why the long prison sentence option is not good, even if you're a believer in punishment as the key to crime control. As to some of the wackier gun control strategies, I said some of them were especially knuckleheaded. That probably accounts for most popular alternatives in recent years, but I guess if I had to mention some in particular, certainly the most popular strategy is, strictly speaking, not even legislative gun control. It's suing gun companies, which is just gun control by other means. And I find this to be one of the indications of prohibitionist intent among groups like Handgun Control, which is the principal organizer and provider of intellectual rationale for the suits against gun companies. It basically says, we're going to sue you because you didn't make a gun that was accident-proof or theft-proof or whatever. And they're actually willing to sue the companies for not having introduced technologies that don't even exist. Or they exist, or they're unreliable, they're just, you know, something on a test bench or a blueprint or whatever. I'd be more worried about this if I didn't know that this really is not going to go very far. The America's elite is worried about this one because they can basically see how that logic could be applied to other industries, not just unpopular ones like tobacco and guns. It could easily be applied probably first to alcohol and then to the motor vehicles is a real obvious one. Which is responsible for far more deaths than guns, and certainly you can argue the same thing. All sorts of safety technology could be introduced. I mean, you could have a governor that doesn't allow you to go any faster than 30 miles an hour. I think everybody in the room ought to sue the automobile manufacturers for not having limited the speed of automobiles to 20 or 30 miles an hour. Of course, it would tend to defeat the purpose of having a car, but. You know, it's not let us that slow us all up from some profitable litigation. To some extent, the most popular methods of gun control are partly popular just because they're nothing measures. I mean, a nothing measure would be like a waiting period. Most people who get guns and then use them in acts of violence, they really don't get them at the last minute. Partly because what criminologists know about the people mostly responsible for crime is they're chronic, and they do lots of crime, not just one, and they do one and again and again and again. And if they had a reason for getting a gun specifically for criminal purposes, they're likely to have had it years ago, long before they ended up finally using it to commit a homicide. I guess the NRA's variant of the more punishment strategy is mandatory add-ons for committing crimes with guns. I mean, if you'd normally get 10 years for a robbery, you get another 2 or 5 or whatever for doing it with a gun. And all sorts of people like that one. I mean, that's a winner. 85-90% of the American public will support that. Prosecutors love it, cops love it, and it's stupid. You know, I don't love it, and you know, really nobody actually responds to these objections. The objections, of course, are all those that I laid out about lengthening prison sentence, plus a lot of other stuff. It tends to pervert enforcement priorities. the smart way to control crime is basically to focus on high-frequency offenders, but basically, if you're going to tell prosecutors, you will get a stiffer sentence, you will have a stiffer punishment to impose if you go after these guys who've done robberies with guns and so on. Prosecutors love that. I mean, they sort of define their success by how punitive, how many really long sentences they can impose. And they may do that even though this particular offender doesn't have any other priors. It's his first and only offense. Meanwhile, he's got a guy who did a robbery without a gun, and he's got a rap sheet as long as your arm. From a crime control standpoint, you don't want to go after the guy who allows you as a prosecutor to impose the longest sentence. You basically want to go after the guy who seems to be the one likeliest to offend again if you don't prosecute him and convict him and put him in prison. And really, I would not like to see any further inducements for prosecutors to kind of go after less serious offenders. Well, you can go through some of the more inane options for gun control, but I don't want to hog all the time, and I'm sure Dave has a fine set of examples of his own. Thank you.